The other great fundamental of a marriage is the level of respect that a spouse has to have for the other. And initially, that may not come naturally. Initially, it's a decision. This is somebody that I could love. This is someone I have an affinity to. And some of that respect has to be a decision of respect. The Talmud talks, for example, if the woman makes two bowls of soup, one of them is inferior to the other. So the Talmud discusses, you know, how does she bring the soup to the table? Does he get the chipped plate? Does she get the chipped plate? If one piece of chicken burnt, who gets it? It doesn't necessarily come naturally in the beginning. You know, like automatically, I give this to you. That probably would come from someone who has a lack of self-esteem initially. But what happens is that if you train yourself after a period of time, I love you so much, I want you to have the better one. And, you know, it sometimes becomes a contest. No, I want you to have the better one. Eventually, someone has to give in. Take a look at the Rambam's description. These two paragraphs alone can blow us away in understanding what a marriage is supposed to be. Our sages commanded that a man should honor his wife more than himself and love her like himself. Let's digest that. How does a man go ahead? I'm only talking to the men now. Women aren't allowed to listen. How does a man honor his wife more than himself, but we acknowledge that you can only love her like yourself?
Well, since you can't really sacrifice yourself for somebody, so you can just go beyond loving yourself. So, like, loving is yourself, it's like the highest point you can possibly reach.
Good. Our principle, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you love your neighbor like yourself. You can't love your neighbor more than yourself. It doesn't work. Because love is a result of good self-esteem. You respect yourself, and then you're able to overflow love for other people. We don't demand that you love someone else more than yourself. But honor, you do. You could honor someone more than yourself. And particularly in a marriage where we recognize that the two people are individuals, are two different people with different likes and different needs, you do have to go ahead and honor the other person more than yourself. My joke always is, if the husband loves blueberry yogurt and he brings his wife a case of blueberry yogurt, but she likes chocolate. And you're off base.
He's loving her like himself.
Yeah. So love her, honor her more than yourself, right? You have to go ahead and apply it according to the other person's needs. When it comes before Yom Tov, which is a more focused example, the husband buys himself something, according to the Talmud, a bottle of wine. In their society, the husband would be joyous with a bottle of wine, but the woman gets a dress. And the guys always ask, excuse me.
Likes both.
Good. The joke, of course, is, you know, I was satisfied with $10. And she's getting a dress. Honor her more than yourself. Two individuals, different needs. We have to recognize that before we even start.
Is the difference that loving is a feeling, but honoring is an action? And that
to a great extent, yes. Loving is a state, a fact. And our principle is love your neighbor as yourself. It has to be an overflow action of good self-esteem. But honor, you can take action. Action can be mandated. And you can take action, and that's fine. Yeah.
But that's assuming that somebody, a man is not miserable, guy who doesn't really love himself.
So we're going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
He's not allowed to be miserable. He's not allowed not to love himself. Isn't that great? I love halacha. Halacha tells you when you're allowed to be sad and when you're allowed to be happy. And, you know, you're not allowed to be sad. Too bad. Put a smile on your face. Isn't that great?
It makes life easy. You just follow the law.
You just right. You have to know what you're required to do. Take
well,
a look.
You know, knowing myself, I know I went through the periods of time when I love myself and keep myself.
So, learn halacha. Okay, we'll see. The techniques. He should provide for her benefit according to his wealth. If a guy is more wealthy, he does have to provide different things. He should not place upon her unwarranted fear. And his speech with her shall always be pleasant. And finally, he shall not be depressed or angry. The commentaries observe that the Rambam, Maimonides, when he wrote this, did not write, he shall not be depressed or angry at her. It's not what it says. It says he shall not be depressed or angry because it poisons the home. I'm not angry at you! So why are you frowning? My boss, my colleague, my rabbi, what are you so angry about? Nothing to do with you. Yeah, but you're angry at my supper table. In the words of the ultimate wife, if you were truly pleased with me, nothing else would matter. And that is a goal that a person has to have. Second paragraph. Men aren't allowed to listen, I guess, to the second paragraph. Our sages commanded that a woman shall honor her husband more than necessary. How do you honor somebody more than necessary? When you're ready to say it's enough already, you do a drop more. She should respect him and should conduct the home according to his request. He should be in her eyes like a minister or a king, and should yearn to distance that which he dislikes. She should want to protect him the best she can. This is the way of sons and daughters of Israel who are sanctified in their unions. In this way, their dwelling will be pleasant and praiseworthy. That's the Rambam in the Laws of Marriage. Now, there's a joke which you saw I was alluding to. The joke is that men typically like to read the woman paragraph, what she's supposed to be doing for me. And men...
You know,
men.
It's a little bit longer than the men's.
That's because the end has a synopsis.
But it was kind of right.
Men are reading the women are reading the men, right? The point, of course, is that we have to read both. And if we understand both and we recognize what the men are doing for the women and the women are doing for the men, you'll detect a true aura of us, as we call it, that we're making the marriage work to the point, as we mentioned last week, that a Jewish home is considered a mini sanctuary, a mikdash ma'at, and we're in it for the service. When you go ahead and bring a cup of tea to somebody, whether it's the woman or the man, someone's not feeling well, you go ahead and you do something, that's not just a nice gesture. That's the same as the service of the Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash. You are oiling the machine. You're making the machine called the Jewish home work smoothly. And that is the goal that we are presented with. Rabbi Friedlander, whose writings are very well accepted in terms of training chasanim and phenomenal insights, he writes that one of the great flaws that people have in marriages is when their spouse asks them advice about something, they think that they're being nice by letting the spouse make the decision. Let's be give a practical case. A woman is trying to put up a picture in the living room, and she asks her husband, "Do you think I should put it a little higher or a little lower?" And the husband thinks he's being generous by saying, "Whatever you do is fine." Right? She's choosing whether she should make a potato kugel or a lakshin kugel for Shabbos. And she asks him, "Whatever you do is great." And he writes that while that's very nice because it avoids conflict, but it's not really the communication that's demanded in a marriage. Because if it's important to her, then it's supposed to be important to you too. And whether that picture goes up or down is supposed to be something that, you know, the world rests on this decision. And the same is the reverse. A husband sometimes, particularly in business, he has a question, he wants to talk it out. If a wife says, you know, whatever you do is good, however you do is fine, he wanted to communicate, he wanted to talk it out. And even if he or she is ultimately not going to follow the exact advice that was given, that's the place to be flexible. But in the dialogue mode, to recognize, that's part of honoring, that if it's important and it needs to be discussed, then it's worthwhile doing so. The second great topic in making a good Jewish marriage is a spin-off of this principle of being happy at all times. And it's actually a job for both husband and wife to be constantly happy. Some people find it comes more naturally than others, but ultimately there's a principle in happiness that we often hinge our happiness on something in the future, on a goal that we have. And if a person does that, then they are defeating themselves by definition. I'll give you an example. If a person has a goal to finish college, and he says, right now I'm striving for the goal, I'm very busy striving for the goal, when I reach the goal, I'll be happy. So then you have a self-definition there that defeats its purpose. You will never be happy, because human beings, particularly Jews, always have to have goals. And if you're going to define yourself that I'll be happy when I achieve the goal, it's impossible for you to be happy, by definition. As opposed to a person who defines happiness by what I have. And I have a goal also. I do have a goal. But my happiness doesn't hinge on the goal. The expression in the Mishnah in Avos, Ezehu Ashir, who is a wealthy person, Hasameach Bechelko, the person who defines his happiness by what he has. Take a look, we'll skip to quote 4 first. Who is wealthy? Rabbi Tarfon said, anyone who has 100 vineyards, 100 fields, and 100 workers. How many of us qualify? Not me. Rabbi Akiva said, anyone who has a wife who is pleasant in her ways. She'll probably be listening to this tape later. I qualify. Rabbi Yossi said, anyone who has a bathroom near his home. I hope we all qualify. Near his home, in his home, you know? A bathroom readily accessible. Person shouldn't have a stomach ache. Fascinating 3 descriptions of what your definition of happiness, of wealth, ought to be. Can anyone guess why they gave such different definitions?
Well, because you... wealth you can define in different ways. Wealth are materialistical terms, right, or emotional. Or,
good. You're ready for the Talmud class. But in the marriage class, it's very simple why they each chose these. Because each one said the things that he had.
Oh.
Reb Tarfon was a wealthy person. So he said, I define wealth by what I have. If God forbid he would lose his wealth, he would redefine wealth to be something that he still has. Rabbi Akiva defined himself by what he had. What did Rabbi Akiva have to his name?
His wife.
His wife, who believed in him, sent him off to study because she believed that he could do it. So that's how he defines wealth. How does Rabbi Yossi define wealth? It's not such an odd thing. Apparently, that's what he had. Apparently, he was able to see in his life something praiseworthy, that he lived near the bathroom. He lived near the outhouse. So it was more convenient for him. And that's how he defined wealth. There was a great Jew in Lakewood who used to say that he's a millionaire. And his kids would look at him like, excuse me, Dad, not that we know of. Is there a Swiss account? He says, I'm a millionaire. Imagine 100 years ago, if someone would have a car, a three-bedroom home, carpet, stairs, 2 bathrooms, he would be a millionaire. So because my neighbor also has it, so now I'm not a millionaire. My self-definition of wealth. You have to transcend. Don't be jealous of the next guy. You're a millionaire. Hashem blessed that in this generation, many, many people are millionaires. Gorgeous. Enjoy it. Define wealth by what you have.
What if you have all of three?
I'm sorry?
What if you have all of three at once?
All three of these?
Yeah.
Show you wealthy.
Which one would define you as well?
So that's up to, you know, that's you have to talk. You have to talk. What gets you going? What causes you appreciation? I actually read a beautiful insight recently that when a person recites modim in Shmona Esrei, he should think of 3 things that he's thankful for. Yeah, don't just, yeah, I'm thankful. Yeah, okay, God, the rabbi said I should be thankful to you. Here, I'm bowing, next. Think of 3 things that you're thankful for. Engage your mind. So, according to the 3-thing rule, Yuri doesn't have a problem, because he's allowed to think of 3 things.
So what you're saying, according to the Jewish law, there is no universal definition of wealth. It's what you define it.
That's correct. Right. Now, there's another thing called success. And Judaism does have definitions of success. Depending on where a person started, a person should be growing, and there's a definition of success. But it's very different depending on the person. But that's a value dictated by Judaism. But wealth is a value dictated by how you handle the circumstances of life. Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what you have. Everyone, if they have the right mindset and follow the halakha, they're wealthy. Just being alive is wealthy.
Correct.
Just breathing and getting up in the morning is wealthy.
Correct.
Have your life.
Right.
So
a person...
Everybody who is wealthy, as long as they appreciate and think in that way.
Right. So that's a life skill, to learn how to focus when you're defining happiness. That doesn't mean you can't have goals. A guy has a goal.
Right.
He wants to retire at a certain age. But your happiness doesn't hinge on fulfillment of the goal. Your happiness... you have to enjoy the ride, too. Yeah.
Is that inappropriate, or is that not the best time to do it? Or
at the end of prayer, we have a lot of liberty. At the end of Shmoneh Esrei, there's a lot of liberty. And you communicate with Hashem. That's fine. What we're pointing out is a basic philosophy in Jewish prayer, and that the text of the prayer is the same day after day, 3 times a day. to the point that the words should eventually have proficiency. You should be proficient in them, and they should go smoothly, to the point that your mind is actually a little bit available for thought. Now, we have the terrible joke of the guy who was busy davening Shemona Esrei, and when he finished, his Rebbe taps him on the shoulder and asks him, "So how was Hong Kong?" I saw, your mind is everywhere because you're able to just daven and you're just going and doing it. So the mind is available. It's available.
Oh, okay.
And it should be filled with whatever the principle of that blessing is. Whatever that paragraph is about, you want to engage the mind on that paragraph. Yeah.
Well, I do, because I don't know the Hebrew. I read the Hebrew, but I don't know what I'm saying, reading. So, but I see the English heading. So it says Thanksgiving. So then I'm reading it in Hebrew, but I'm thinking of the three or two things, whatever number it is in that paragraph. And I try to even make sure in advance I have something to say in different paragraphs.
Perfect. Like perfect. That.
But
perfect.
While I'm reading the Hebrew, which,
Perfect. Some people have greater skill in the Hebrew and the mind is really empty. Other people are struggling with the words and, their mind is already engaged. But either way, whatever works for you, you can pause for a moment and think, what is it in terms of machshava, in terms of thought, that I'm investing into this blessing?